The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Content warning. This episode contains discussion of murder and violence.
In a couple of past interviews, we've gotten insights from a criminal defense attorney from the southern part of the United States. Today, we're talking with him once more, this time about a case that has come to haunt him.
We're referring to a case many refer to as America's Jack the Ripper. It's the Zodiac Killer, a serial murderer who preyed upon victims in Northern California in the late 60s and early 70s. Not only that, but he also teased and taunted the public, the press, and law enforcement with coded messages and ciphers.
Our guest has been studying the case for over a decade and has many interesting insights and observations. And he has a unique perspective because, as he reminded us, he has represented clients who have been accused of doing acts very similar to what the Zodiac did.
My name is Anya Kane. I'm a journalist.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee. I'm an attorney.
We first connected while looking into the Burger Chef murders, an Indiana cold case. Together, we built a spreadsheet documenting hundreds of cases of restaurant-related homicides. That original spreadsheet gave way to our podcast, The Murder Sheet.
Now we maintain that same research-centric, investigative approach as we look into all sorts of homicides, including unsolved cases, historical crimes, and, of course, restaurant murders.
We don't just chat about the headlines. Our podcast is a platform for our journalism. The Murder Sheet focuses on investigative reporting, thoughtful analysis, thorough research, and in-depth interviews. We're The Murder Sheet.
And this is The Zodiac Killer, an overview of the case. Can we start by having you give us just a brief overview of the crimes of the Zodiac?
Yes. The Zodiac Killer was a serial killer who operated in the San Francisco Bay Area in the late 1960s. And he was he's kind of the stereotypical Lover's Lane killer, except for one stark difference. So there are four canonical events. That's how the Zodiac research community kind of they classify it. There are four events that almost everybody agrees is the work of one serial killer. And the first of those was a Lover's Lane killing of a young couple on December 20th, 1968 in Benicia, California, which is, at that time was an unincorporated area, southeast of Vallejo. July 4th of 1969, another couple were at a park in Vallejo and were shot. The female died and the male lived. And we'll come back and talk about details on these, but just given a chronology. And then on September 27th of 1969, there was an attack at a lake north of the San Francisco Bay Area, just northeast of Napa, California, Lake Berryessa. And again, two individuals were attacked, and this time it was by knife. The first two times it was gunshots. And again, the female died and the male lived. And then on October 11th of 1969, a cab driver by the name of Paul Stein was killed in his cab in San Francisco proper. And those are the confirmed or the accepted canonical events that comprise the Zodiac killings. And what made it famous and what kind of tied them together was he had a propensity to taunt police and newspapers by mailing things and taking credit for the killings and the fact that they had not been solved. And so those are the four events. There are many others that since that time have been tied to the Zodiac case with varying degrees of acceptance. But those are the four main events that are fairly well accepted in the community.
Without going into too much detail, could you tell us a bit about how you became interested in this case?
Well, it's pretty obvious now. This is my third time talking to you about different true crime events. I have grown up from a young age being very interested in true crime before it was even called a true crime, you know, community. So I was interested in Jack the Ripper and, you know, those sort of things from an early age. And as I grew older, it's a form of entertainment in a way to examine these kind of cases. But it's also for me, it's a way to buttress the work that I do. It makes me think carefully about the cases that I have in real life by reviewing some of these older cases. And so I was familiar with Zodiac and had actually already been to a couple of websites years previous to my real interest developing. And mostly at first I was fascinated by the ciphers that he had mailed, and particularly the 340 being unsolved. We'll talk about that later. But that cipher was unsolved, and I thought I could figure out a way to solve it. And so that interested me early on. But then what happened was I just kind of stumbled on to, quite by accident, a person that I thought fit a lot of the characteristics of the Zodiac Killer, who, after doing quite a bit of research on him, I'm still not dissuaded from my view. And so once I discovered this person and his potential link to the case, I just became more and more interested and started going to all the websites, getting all the books and reading all of the ones that I could find. And in particular, Tom Voigt and Mike Morford have some websites that are really good and contain a lot of good information on them. And I spent a lot of time on those two websites reviewing the information that was there.
As our guest mentioned, he does indeed have his own suspect in the case. We are not asking him about who that person is, because our guest will someday probably reveal his thinking in detail in a book. Meanwhile, he has a great many other insights and observations to share with us.
You talked a little bit about the ciphers. Can you talk a little bit more about that and say, what exactly are those?
Well, a cipher is I'm no expert on this kind of stuff, but I know there's a difference between a cipher and a code, but I couldn't quite tell you what. But basically what ended up happening is that the person who titled himself as the Zodiac, sent some coded or enciphered messages that supposedly were, at various times he said they would do different things if you could solve them. But the very first one was a 408 character cipher that he split up into three parts and mailed to three different newspapers, and basically was engaging in some he was trying to coerce the newspapers to print this by saying he was going to kill some people if they didn't print it. And eventually all three did print it, but it was in three separate parts, and you had to put it together to make a single coded message. And that message was decoded or decrypted very quickly. But he also he did a couple of other short ciphers that are almost going to be impossible to ever solve. But the one that is probably the most famous is what they call the 340, and that is a 340 character cipher that was mailed. And I forget where he mailed that one exactly, but it remained unsolved or undecoded for over 50 years. And it is it's particularly interesting that, you know, there were efforts made by lots of the NSA, for example, as I understand, the CIA, different organizations took a stab at trying to figure out what this code was, and their computer methods to analyze things like this. And you can see, or they could see, that there was information in the code. It wasn't just a rambling jumbled bit of mess to confuse people. There was information there, but they just couldn't decode it. And that, to me, is incredibly fascinating, because that means that the Zodiac Killer was somebody who was smart enough to make a code that could not be decoded or ciphered, undeciphered for over 50 years by some of the best minds that do that kind of work. And so that's one of the things that was just really fascinating to me about him. There was a team of three researchers who were independent researchers who were in the Zodiac community, basically. And it was middle of last year, maybe, I think, that they finally were able to break that cipher. And there wasn't much of other than just bragging and boasting about how great of a serial killer he was and how nobody could catch him. That sort of was the message. But it's just it was interesting that it lasted so long before anybody was able to figure out how to get the information out of that cipher. There is a 13-character cipher that remains unsolved to this day, and as I understand it, it's probably too short to ever be reliably decoded. And then there's a 32 cipher message that was also sent at some point. And there have been a number of other ciphers that it's not entirely sure whether the Zodiac Killer sent them or whether it was somebody else. And some of those have been deciphered and some have not.
You mentioned, you could certainly say, you can certainly understand why people have been so intrigued with this case, you know, given the ciphers and given, you know, the possibility that somebody could crack them and whatnot. One thing I'm curious about is, and this is probably the first question a lot of, you know, people who are new to the Zodiac case ask, how can we be totally certain that the canonical cases are all the same person? Is there any specific physical evidence or other evidence linking them definitively?
It is a very frustrating set of crimes to look into from a layperson's perspective, because even 54 years later, the files of the law enforcement investigation agencies have not been released publicly. And so we don't know everything that they know. But basically what ended up happening is that with each passing murder, there was some form of communication that is reliably from the Zodiac that was, that referenced the other crimes. And so he was basically taking, he was taking ownership of each passing crime. After the second murder in July of 1969, he made a phone call from a payphone to the police department and said, there's no recording supposedly, but he said to the operator that he wanted to report a double murder at the park. And he was also the person that killed the two kids the winter before. And so he took credit for it during his reporting of the second crime. But there were also, each particular murder would require looking at all of the communications that were sent, but he would give away, either by telephone or in writing, information that was true but not publicly released about previous crimes. And another famous example is that in the September 1969 case at Lake Berryessa, he wrote in some sort of marker on the door of the male who survived that event. He wrote on the door of his car dates that corresponded to the previous two incidents and described how they had occurred by gun and then in this case by knife. I think there's probably a lot more that the public doesn't know about that connects it, but it's just through the series of his communications that it is fairly reliably placed upon him that he did all four of those canonical events.
Yeah, interesting. I've always wondered that because I haven't immersed myself in the Zodiac case like you have or like some people have, but the MOs being somewhat different and then the fact that this was also highly publicized, it sort of seems like it would be easy to start, you know, making claims in letters without actually having carried out, you know, all of the crimes, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But
are some researchers in the community who believe there were four or maybe three unrelated events, and two of them were together and the other two were not. But I don't think that really holds water. And I think that, you're exactly right. The fact that the MOs were so different makes it seem like it could be that they weren't connected. But if you detect the pattern of the writing, what he referenced, what he talked about, what information that wasn't really public at the time, it's fairly certain that all four of these were the work of one killer. And the most fascinating, of course, which we know that was the Zodiac, was there was a letter that was written in October of 1969. And received by the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, within maybe 2 days of the murder of Paul Stein, the cab driver. And the letters were examined, that letter was examined compared to other letters, and it was conclusive that, according to the, you know, as conclusive as that sort of thing can be, that it was written by the same person who had written the previous letters, but included in that letter was a piece of a bloody shirt that had been torn away from the body of the cab driver, and it was included in the mailing. So the pattern matched, and there are pictures that show that his shirt was definitely torn. And, you know, so we know that that person who wrote the previous letters definitely, as definite as we could know something like this, definitely was the murderer of the cab driver. So there's just lots of little details that you have to add up all together to come to that conclusion that they're all four connected.
Right.
What's more fun than living out your own cozy mystery?
You know, Kevin and I love to explore real life mysteries. Well, sometimes it's a nice break to get immersed in a fictional mystery story. And playing the free to download hidden object game June's Journey is just like starring in your own caper.
This game is a great way to sharpen your observational skills and encourage yourself to take quick, re-energizing breaks throughout the day. You play as June Parker, a flapper / sleuth who navigates jazz age mysteries with aplomb.
In between levels, you can also build up your own fancy island estate. And you know I'm all about that. You can plant flowers, float on swan ponds, and even set loose a beautiful horse. It's very fun.
We enjoy playing this game when we're waiting around for a source to call us back, or when we're stuck outside waiting for a courthouse to open up. It's great fun.
Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. At The Murder Sheet, we're all about immersive audio experiences.
That's why we love Audible. An Audible subscription gives you access to thousands of audiobook titles. We especially enjoy their robust selection of mysteries, thrillers, and true crime.
I love Audible. I've really enjoyed listening to A Wicked Snow by Greg Olson. This story is all about a CSI investigator with a dark past and a terrible family secret. When I'm listening to Audible, it plunks me right down in the middle of the story. It's so spine-tingling that I can practically feel the cold air on my skin. Audible is your one-stop destination for thrillers and mysteries. Just be prepared to get spooked in the best possible way.
Listening to audiobooks offers a wonderful respite from the day. Audible allows you to listen on the go. I love taking a walk or a drive and just getting lost in a story. My favorite audiobook on Audible so far is Presumed Innocent, the book track edition. This classic legal thriller by Scott Turow is enhanced by a gripping musical soundtrack that amplifies the story's suspense and profound emotional beats.
As a new member, you can try out Audible for free for 30 days. This is such a valuable membership, and you get access to so many new listening experiences, including podcasts, Audible originals, and Audible exclusives, like the Words Plus Music series.
Visit audible.com/msheet or text msheet to 500-500.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
And then you mentioned, you know, there's been attempts in years since to basically link other crimes to this kind of series. And I'm wondering, do you find any of those other possible linked crimes particularly credible as far as, you know, possible Zodiac kills?
There are several that are really interesting. The first of those to arise, chronologically speaking, the first non-canonical crime that seemed to have been connected to Zodiac was one that Zodiac actually took credit for, at least obliquely, in some of his letters to the Chronicle. And that is the 1966 murder of Sherry Jo Bates in Riverside, California. And, you know, geographically speaking, Riverside and San Francisco, you know, they are a lot further apart than they sound. California is a very large state, and it would take hours to drive today between those two locations. And, in fact, investigators flew from San Francisco down to Los Angeles to talk to the investigators down there. So it's a long way away and separated only by 2.5-3 years. But there was a newspaper article that had been written saying that the murder of Sherry Jo Bates seemed to be very similar to the murders in San Francisco. And then Zodiac responded by taking credit, obliquely at least, for that murder. And that one seems like it is connected in some way. My own personal theory is that he didn't murder her, but he was aware of it and he was in that area. But that's based on information that I've uncovered on my own research. But it seems like he was aware of that particular murder. There are a couple of other events that occurred prior to the canonical Zodiac murders, and there's a June of 1963 murder on the beach near Santa Barbara. A couple of high school students had gone on a senior skip day down to the beach from Lompoc, which was where they were going to school, and they ended up being shot to death on the beach and had gone missing they were missing for a while. They were discovered, and then as the investigation into that unsolved murder unfolded, they made connections between it and the murders in the San Francisco Bay Area. And there are investigators in that case who have said that they are convinced that it was the same person based on information that's not been publicly released. But that particular murder does bear an uncanny resemblance to what happened in Lake Berryessa, also on a beach, basically. Two individuals were tied up with pre-cut links of rope at Lake Berryessa and in Santa Barbara. So those two crimes seem very similar, and lots of people who have inside knowledge seem to think that they are connected. And I think it's very possible that they are connected. There's cab driver in Oceanside in 1961 who was murdered, and there were taunting phone calls made both before and after that murder. And so that's an MO of the Zodiac Killer. And so that could also be connected, and I'm agnostic about that one personally, but it very well could be. And then there were some events that occurred after the Zodiac Killer canonical spree ended. In March of 71, I believe that a lady was driving on the highway. Her name is Kathleen Johns. It was late at night. She had a baby, and somebody flashed their lights at her from behind in an attempt to get her to pull over. They said, "Hey, it looks like your wheel's going to fall off. I'll fix it for you." And that person did fix it for her, allegedly. And as she drove off, the wheel fell off. And so he said, "Well, just get in the car with me, and I'll take you to safety." And according to her story, she ultimately, after riding around with him for depending on which version you believe, a few minutes to up to several hours, she jumped out of the car with the baby. And then when she reported the incident, she at the police department, she pointed to a sketch of the Zodiac Killer and said, "That's the man that tried to kidnap me." That one falls outside of the MO, in my opinion. If there's no abductions other than that we know of that is canonical. So that one seems a little bit less likely in my mind. But then the other one that I think is could potentially be a Zodiac crime is the abduction of a 25-year-old nurse at her employment in Stateline, Nevada, which is basically a straight shot from San Francisco through Sacramento over to Nevada. And what's interesting about her, she went to work and she just disappeared. She didn't come home, and nobody saw her after she had finished her shift. And what's really interesting is she worked at a hospital in San Francisco that was within a mile of the location where the cab driver had been shot and killed in October of 1969. And her abduction was in September of 1971. So almost 2 years later, she was abducted and never heard from again. And Zodiac, again, he's very oblique in the way he references things, but apparently some people take one of his communications to mean that he was taking credit for her abduction. That one seems like it is more likely of a Zodiac crime as an abduction than the Kathleen Johns abduction because she at least had a connection to that area, and there's not really to the area where Zodiac had been operating, and there's not really a real solid connect between Kathleen Johns and the Zodiac prior to that. So, but there are, and then depending on what website you're looking at, you can also connect some of the most famous unsolved cases of all U.S. history, but those are the ones that seem most likely to have some sort of a connection to the Zodiac Killer.
Absolutely. I mean, and what you're describing, just the sheer amount of crimes, but the possibly linked as well as the canonically linked. What did this spate of crimes do to the area in which they occurred at the time? I mean, as you mentioned, there's this media connection. Are there these taunting letters to the media and law enforcement? All these brutal cases. Can you kind of describe the societal impact that this case had?
Well, it's funny. I'm an old guy now, I feel like, and I'm starting to look into retirement plans and figure out what I'm going to do when I no longer practice law and that sort of thing. And I wasn't even born when the Zodiac killing happened, when that spate of crimes occurred. And so, obviously I don't have any firsthand knowledge, but I've done a lot of reading of newspaper articles from that time, and it terrified the community, and particularly what terrified them was the boldness and the brashness of taking credit for the crime, committing the crime, and basically bragging that you're not going to catch me. That was the tone of his communication. And, one of the reasons why people do investigate other crimes to figure out if they may be connected is because one of the things that he did was at the bottom of his communications, he had a running scorecard. He would put the Zodiac symbol that he created, and he would have a number next to it. And I think the largest number he ever got to was 37. Later he put guess, and SFPD 0. you know, he was taunting the police and taunting the community with the idea that he's continuing to commit these commit crimes and get away with it. And the San Francisco Police Department and other agencies there couldn't catch him. And so one of the things that he did, I think he capitalized on that kind of terror, because when he was almost, depending on whose version you believe, of course, but he was almost caught, I think, at the crime scene for the Paul Stein murder in October of 69 in downtown San Francisco. And some of his next communications were describing how he was going to commit crimes against school buses full of children, and that he was going to blow up bombs next to school buses, and that he was going to shoot children as they got off the school buses. And there were, you know, I know that, you know, I've seen newspaper read newspaper articles, seen news television accounts of it. It terrified the community. And, I'm quite certain that, you know, as people were growing up, they were being told, don't go to the lover's lanes. Don't go to these secluded spots, because if you do, then there's potential that the Zodiac Killer could get you. And it had to have been a terrifying thing to live in that area and know that someone who is quite capable and willing to kill was out there, not behind bars, and was not only killing, but bragging about it.
Some of these crimes are just so heinous and disturbing. And then the fact that the person is bragging about it, taunting the police. You know, what can we extrapolate from that about what kind of person would do this, personality, you know, maybe a bit of a profile of what this kind of person would look like, or, you know, be like, I guess.
Well, you know, there are books and articles and all kinds of things that have been written that suggest various different profiles. Some people think that he was had particular personality traits, and then other professionals think he had the exact opposite. But I think that this is, for me personally, based on the reading that I've done, and you know, frankly, representing people who have been charged with some crimes like this, it seems like he was somebody who had a personal vendetta against law enforcement for some reason. There is a theory that maybe he had applied to become a law enforcement officer and was rejected for whatever reason. But the fact that he would put SFPD in zero at the bottom of many of his letters suggested that it was personal for him. I also think that the fact that, you know, the acceptance of some of the non-canonical crimes would influence how you view him and his personality. Because if, you know, the murder of Sherry Jo Bates was just one female individual killed. And with the exception of that and the Paul Stein killing, the ones that I think are most likely connected were all groups. There were couples involved. And that to me suggests that there was some kind of angst about relationships and about how men and women relate to each other. And there, you know, famously, one of the police chiefs there said that he was probably exhibited homosexual violence. And you know, there may be a questioning of his own sexuality that was involved. But I think that there had to be some sort of self-doubt there about and questioning his own self-worth for him to drive around and shoot people who were engaging in activities that he probably wasn't able to for whatever reason. That's what it feels like to me, is that he's that kind of person. But then he not only did he have to do that to express his own inner rage at not being able to find some sort of romantic or sexual fulfillment, you know, he then had to, he coupled that with an independent desire to engage in a vendetta against law enforcement and say, not only am I doing these murders, but I'm also evading capture. And so I think it fulfilled a couple of different things. And the more he did it and the more he got away with it, the more confident he became as a person, I think. You know, there's a fairly well-accepted idea that serial killers don't just stop. And in reality, we know that is not true. They do stop. They have reasons for stopping, though. If you look at Gary Ridgway, he stopped when he got married and was having a good, successful marriage. And when that marriage crumbled, he resumed
the Green River killers. BTK stopped for a good long time. And serial killers stop when the need to do the killing is satisfied some other way. And personally, I believe that Zodiac probably, you know, there's ideas that he went to prison, he was in a mental hospital, he died, he went in the military, went overseas. You know, there's all kinds of reasons to explain why he stopped, but apparently continued to live because there were communications that occurred for years after the canonical events ceased. But my own personal thought on that is that he gained so much confidence from engaging in the killings and then not getting caught that it gave him confidence to move on in life and do some other things that were accepted, you know, and legal, things that would satisfy whatever urge he had to kill, but do it in a way that was not illegal. And so I think he was probably somebody who was just shy and not very self-confident, but as the events occurred, went on, as they continued, he gained more and more confidence. And that's why, you know, if you look at, there are patterns that really kind of help explain events and in general, but in specifically with the Zodiac, you see the first crime he did not, in December 20th, 1968, he didn't call anybody, he didn't write anybody, he just shot a couple of kids and nothing else happened. And he got away with it for several months. And then July rolls around of the next year and he kills, he shoots a couple of people, the female dies and the male lives, but he thought he had managed to kill both of them. And he drives to a payphone within a mile. From what I understand, you can see the police department from the payphone where he made the call, and calls and not only brags about that crime, but about the crime that he committed the year before. So it shows an increase in confidence that he would not make any public statements at all about the first crime and then go to the second crime and take credit for both of them. Because he feels like at this point, I can get away with both of them. I can get away with all of it. Now, I want people to know how great I am as a serial killer. And so I'm going to go in and take credit for it, for both of them. And he had not even at that point even written any letters. And so the letter writing campaign actually began, and then it sort of seemed to replace the actual homicide. The letter writing gave him the satisfaction. The terrorizing of the community gave him the satisfaction that he was looking for and had received previously by committing the murders. And there are so many letters. If you read the letters, you can just kind of get a sense of the tone. And as he goes on, it's just an increasing confidence and an increasing need for attention.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
And I mean, like, gosh, I mean, this is kind of the obvious question that pops into your head. But I mean, these murders are so bold. He's, you know, and then he's, you know, continuing to communicate. We all know that, you know, BTK ran into trouble when he started corresponding with police again, you know, in the early 2000s, and led to, you know, a situation where he was sort of trapped into making a huge technological mistake. But how did the Zodiac not get caught? That's my question. I mean, he's styling himself as this criminal genius, but a lot of this stuff seems like it would have been cracked if he tried this today because of advances in forensic technology. But what sort of benefited him back when he was committing these crimes?
Well, what benefited him was is that he was one of the first. You know, there had been previous serial killing kind of sprees. There were things that happened. There was the Axeman of New Orleans, and you know, the Black Dahlia was a famous event in Los Angeles. There were things that had occurred previously, and cases that had gone unsolved. But he was really the first one in the United States, anyway, that wrote letters and took credit for it, and you know, basically invited the reviewing of his crimes that he committed. And today, you know, there's almost everybody, I think, in the Zodiac community believes that if these events were occurring today, he'd be caught very quickly. And, of course, there's technology that would enable that, exists today that didn't exist back then. You've got surveillance cameras, cell phones, and your vehicles have tracking devices, whether from the manufacturer that are placed there. There's all kinds of technological advances that would make it so much easier to catch him today. The internet didn't exist back then, and the linking crimes across jurisdictional boundaries was a much larger problem back then than it is today. And I don't think it was by accident that all of the canonical crimes and even all of the non-canonical crimes that are loosely associated with Zodiac Killer are all in different jurisdictions for law enforcement purposes. But no single there were no two events that were investigated by one single law enforcement agency primarily, and even Vallejo and Benicia were, even though they're only separated by a couple of miles, those two locations, they were primarily responsible agencies were two different agencies. And so the Vallejo Police Department, Napa, or the Paris Park, Solano County. The fact that it was one of the first instances where people were trying to investigate multiple events but were not aware of the existence of or potential link to other crimes, in another county over, another city over. I think that was a big thing that helped him. And of course, you know, there are a lot of advances in DNA. DNA technology did not exist in 1968 and 69. So even though there are lots of crimes that are being solved today through the use of various forms of DNA technology, it would have required properly storing the evidence that was collected, and proper collection as well. And I just don't think that occurred in this case. And so there is DNA work being conducted, as I understand it, into this case to this day. But if those crimes had happened today, he would almost certainly have been caught through DNA, if nothing else. But, you know, it was just an earlier time in the world of criminal justice, and there were less sophisticated techniques used to solve these crimes. There was less opportunity for law enforcement to actually lay eyes on the person. Because of the different, you know, no surveillance cameras basically existed at that point, and it was going to be a luck of the draw kind of thing for them to see him in the midst of committing the action. So it was just basically happenstance, I think, that he just happened to be operating at a time when law enforcement techniques were not sophisticated enough to catch him.
We found in like cases we've looked into, like for example, the Burger Chef murders. That's a situation where, you know, one law enforcement body thinks it's suspect A, the other one thinks it's B, and then C, and like you go down the line and everybody has a totally different opinion. And, you know, in other situations, it's actually like a little bit more cut and dry. You have like everybody be like, we're pretty sure it's this guy, but we can't prove it. And I'm just curious, do you know if there's any sort of official thought on, you know, from law enforcement, is there any sort of indication that they think it's somebody, or do you think that they're probably pretty open-minded at this point?
Well, I've personally communicated with a number of law enforcement officers who are
currently assigned, or at the time I communicated, were assigned to investigating Zodiac. And I'll tell you, based on the research I've done and my communication with them, they are very tight-lipped about what they believe. And I think that some of that jurisdictional jockeying that was occurring in the late 60s and early 70s investigating this case has continued to this day. I think that there is no real theory about who committed these crimes, unless they are just holding it completely close to the vest and not disclosing any information at all. I don't think that there's uniformity amongst the law enforcement agencies about who did it or where, you know, what happened or any of those things. I think that they're cooperating now much more than they were, and the investigation, the FBI actually helped at some point, and then in the California Bureau of Investigation or Department of Justice, whatever it is out there, their state agency got involved and has a case, and as I understand it, is still an active case. And so they sort of had to, those local law enforcement agencies had to cooperate because the state agency and the FBI were getting involved. So there has been a minimal amount of cooperation, and I think that they are probably cooperating more now than they ever were. But I don't think that any of these agencies really at this point have a clue who the Zodiac Killer was.
And that's interesting, because when you go on websites and stuff, you see a lot of people putting forth suspects. Do you just, mm-hmm. as an educated follower of the case, do you have an opinion about some of the more prominent suspects that have been mentioned?
Well, the suspects seem to fall into two categories. The suspects that have been developed, at least in the modern era, from the late 80s moving forward, they fall into two categories. Number one, the "my daddy did it" category, or this guy was, you know, close to that location, so he must have done it, and he was kind of weird category. So, you know, by and large, I don't really find much that compels me to believe any of the suspects that have been publicly identified as suspects are, in fact, the Zodiac. There's, you know, basically what you have is that some people look like the sketches. And the best example of that is Earl Van Best. You know, he is a suspect that's been identified, and he looks like the Zodiac Killer. But beyond that, there's almost no evidence. I mean, and he was, you know, not a nice guy, apparently. He committed some crimes, but there's not really anything that ties him to the crime other than he looks like Zodiac. And by and large, that seems to be the first criterion that any independent investigator uses to evaluate a suspect. And I mean, frankly, even I did that whenever I stumbled upon somebody that I thought was Zodiac. That was the first thing that struck me, was the appearance. But I think you have to have more than just an appearance. And, you know, some are laughable and some are more credible than that. But by and large, I don't think anybody has publicly identified the person who really was a Zodiac as the Zodiac Killer.
In terms of, I mean, are there any other, I guess, maybe misconceptions or myths about this case that you think have pervaded the public mindset?
Well, I think that the various announcements that the Zodiac case has been solved is probably more accepted by the public than it ought to be. You know, like I said, I'm getting nearing retirement age, and I wasn't even alive at that point. So the people that were alive, and especially people alive and were adults at that time, is becoming a vanishingly small number of people. So about the actual events, I don't know that there are many misconceptions about the events, but I think that the random person who knows anything about Zodiac would, I think, conclude that it's been solved, and it is not at all solved. But it's the confidence with which the various researchers and groups announce, you know, breathlessly, "Oh, we solved Zodiac," you know, and people accept it without really looking into the claims that they're making. And I think that's probably, I don't know if maybe, you know, between that misperception and time passing, I think those two things are going to end up with forcing these law enforcement agencies into spending their time and resources on other projects that are, you know, more in the public eye and closer in time
to us today than the Zodiac. And so at some point, that kind of public misperception is going to end up leading to Zodiac, the money drying up, resources drying up to solve Zodiac. And it's just not going to. I think that there's a strikingly large possibility that Zodiac will never be solved because the public thinks it's already been solved.
Absolutely. And you're preaching to the choir. I think a real healthy dose of skepticism would be a great thing for the true crime community when looking at claims. And I think it's one thing for a researcher to say, hey, here's a case against somebody that I feel, you know, pretty good about. But but sometimes in the press releases, you see it's like claiming a solve. That's a huge stretch. And it's kind of it's just misleading. And as you said, it actually does harm.
Yes, absolutely. And the most recent, I don't like disparaging anybody, but the most recent claim of that Gary Francis Post was the one that that committed these crimes is so laughable on its face because of the skimpy evidence that they have, and it's mostly again based on, well, he looks like Zodiac, so he's got to be it, and yet it was announced with supposedly the backing of a number of distinguished law enforcement officials. And so it just, once again, it's laughable to those of us who are in the community that investigate this case, that are on the website, that communicate back and forth amongst ourselves. It's laughable to think that Gary Francis Post was the man that committed this crime. And yet, I think that that's probably the number one candidate that people have texted and called me about and said, hey, it's solved. You were wrong. Your guy wasn't it. You know, and it's just laughable to think that somebody like that, based on the evidence that they have, anyway, was Zodiac.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
You mentioned the backing of a lot of prominent law enforcement people with that one. I think people in true crime, people who are listeners consuming true crime, there needs to be a step back from the halo effect, because I think, you know, in many areas we acknowledge that people can have a good career and do a lot of good things but be wrong about, you know, signing on to something. And I don't know. I think there's a lack of I think people need to be a little bit less credulous about this kind of stuff. What were you going to say, Kevin?
I was going to say, you've mentioned your research and you have your own suspect. Do you anticipate making your research and your theories available to the public at some point?
I anticipate it, and maybe that's why I've been looking into my retirement plans, because real work kind of gets in the way of it. I've been working on a book. I've been doing research for about 13 years now, and I kind of stumbled upon a person who I think is a good candidate for being Zodiac. I stumbled upon him by accident, and mostly I was just trying to rule him out by gathering information, but 13 years later and a couple of trips to California later to do research, I have not found anything that rules him out. So I've done quite a bit of research. I've done some drafts of a book, not fully complete, of course, but I need to find some time to devote to sit down and finishing that research. And if God lets me live long enough, then yes, I will release that.
Well, we'd love to. Hopefully it'll be, you know, someday where you can come back on the show and chat about it in depth, because we'd love to have you back on to talk about that.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Yeah. And then I guess, you know, in the meantime, what would you recommend for listeners who are curious and maybe really want to get into the Zodiac case and really be informed? Are there any books or resources that you found especially enlightening as far as kind of getting started in that space?
Well, there are Robert Gray Smith was a political cartoonist at one of the newspapers in San Francisco who did a lot of research on the case. And I think it was in 1987 when he wrote his book. And in the community, it's called The Yellow Book because the cover was yellow. And honestly, I don't even remember the name of the book, but that was the book that catapulted this into the public knowledge, public sphere of where people really took notice of it. It was a really good movie that was directed by David Fincher called Zodiac. And some of that is not exactly historically accurate, of course, because it's a movie, but it gives a good overview of the crimes and some of the personalities that were involved in it. But there are two websites that I consult, and, you know, I save everything with bookmarks. So I don't, you know, these are not my website, but Mike Morford has one, ZodiacKillerSite.com, I think. Tom Voigt also has a website, and his last name is V-O-I-G-T. His is on Tapatalks or Tapatalk or whatever that website is, but they both have it's kind of a message board format that where people contribute information, and you know, there's a lot of actual real good investigation that goes on those two websites, and the information is categorized, you know, like a message board by different categories, and it gives you an opportunity to go and find information on a specific area that is being researched by independent researchers. I'm sure there's a lot of other really good websites out there. I've heard of some other ones. And there's, of course, a million podcasts that go into great depth. But those two websites, the movie and the book by Gray Smith, are probably the first things that I would suggest anybody go to get it, that has no knowledge of Zodiac at all, to get started with the understanding that, of course, the movie's fictional, but it gives a flavor of what the whole thing is about.
And then I'm curious, you know, why do you think this case continues to resonate today in 2023?
The taunting with the communications, that was what got it going, I think, in the 70s and 80s. But, you know, and then the fact that it was it was popularized with the book and the movie that kept it going. But, you know, another thing that some of my friends, when I told them I'm coming on your podcast again to talk about Zodiac, they said, well, how many hours are they going to let you talk? Because I'm trying hard not to get too deep into details. But one of the things that we didn't talk about was at the Lake Berryessa event, he actually showed up with a costume that had apparently been very well designed. That had the Zodiac symbol that he used when he signed his letters on, emblazoned, or maybe even embroidered somehow onto that costume. And there's a pretty famous picture or drawing, rather, of what somebody felt like it looked like. But the fact that he was so flamboyant in how he committed his crime, how he took credit for those crimes, the fact that he was able to create ciphers that lasted unsolved for so long. He's not your typical serial killer who just kills for sexual pleasure and dumps somebody, you know, in the park somewhere. He did more than just killing. As a matter of fact, if you look at how much killing he did compared to how much writing and other things that he did, it's pretty obvious that the killing was not the part that he enjoyed the most. It was taking credit for being the killer that really made him tick, I think. And so it's being so flamboyant, it's a tease of I'm right here, you can find me if you want to, that the public looks at and says, why hasn't this already been solved? Those who don't think it's been solved anyway, why hasn't it been solved? And so as time has gone by, it's just all of these little factors of, I think that this is the first time I've ever used that word, flamboyant, to describe how he acted about his motive. But I think that's actually probably the answer there, that why it was publicly displayed in such a flamboyant way that he not only did the murder, but he got away with it. And it was he was almost cartoonish in a way with his costume and with some of the writing the ciphers and that sort of thing. And so I think there is there's this strain of thought that we sort of romanticize some people who are criminals, you know, in the Depression era and back and before that, when you had the Prohibition, you know, Dillinger and folks like that who robbed the banks to take money away from the rich to give to the poor. That's, you know, the Robin Hood kind of thought process. People somewhat idolized those people, even though they knew they were doing wrong. And then you had Alcatraz, where the three guys escaped and were never found. And, you know, people were in a lot of ways hoping they got away just because, you know, it's putting a thumb in the eye of the man, you know. And you got to remember, this was the late 60s in San Francisco. And so there was, I think that Zodiac was trying to take advantage of that tendency of people to somewhat back the underdog, in, so to speak. And I think in some ways, even though his acts were far more despicable than most of these other people that I've just talked about, I think he kind of managed to achieve that.
And then I imagine there's so much that we did not ask about that you wanted to cover, but maybe we could do some follow-up interviews, but is there anything, what were you going to say?
Yeah, no, I literally could talk for hours and, you know, I think today was a pretty good overview. But I think that, you know, generally speaking, the important thing that when people think about Zodiac is that it's, to understand Zodiac is really a psychological thing, and to understand who he was and why these events happened, it's not your simple superficial sexual thrill or wanting to get some money kind of thing. He was a very deep person, whoever he was. There was a lot to him. And I think that he had many psychological needs that drove him to do what he did. And I think that he was intelligent enough to use different techniques to get away with it. And it's America's Jack the Ripper. It's always going to fascinate people. And if it remains unsolved, like Jack Ripper, but really is, in my opinion, then it's going to always fascinate the public. And there's always going to be speculation and people are always going to inquire into it until it's finally solved. And when it is solved, whether it's my guy or some of the publicly named suspects, I think most everybody's going to say, just like we did with BTK, is that really the guy? Surely it's not. He's just so whatever. You know, it's not, I don't think there's going to be anything special about him. I don't think it's going to be Ed Edwards, you know, that supposedly killed, committed all the unsolved crimes in the country. But I think it's going to fascinate people to know who he is, because I think there's going to be some explanation behind it once we know who he is. But by and large, we're just going to look at him and think, who would have thought that was the guy?
We want to thank our guest for talking with us. And he's making a special offer to listeners of The Murder Sheet. If any of you have questions or comments or theories about the case you'd like to discuss with him, then he is inviting you to contact him directly at ZodiacKillerHunter@outlook.com. That's ZodiacKillerHunter@outlook.com. And if you do write him, please join us in urging him to publish his book on the case soon. We are all anxious to read it. Thanks so much for listening to The Murder Sheet. If you have a tip concerning one of the cases we cover, please email us at murdersheet@gmail.com. If you have actionable information about an unsolved crime, please report it to the appropriate authorities.
If you're interested in joining our Patreon, that's available at www.patreon.com/murdersheet. If you want to tip us a bit of money for records requests, you can do so at www.buymeacoffee.com/murdersheet. We very much appreciate any support.
Special thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee who composed the music for the murder sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
If you're looking to talk with other listeners about a case we've covered, you can join the Murder Sheet discussion group on Facebook. We mostly focus our time on research and reporting, so we're not on social media much. We do try to check our email account, but we ask for patience as we often receive a lot of messages. Thanks again for listening.